I'm Mike Pesca, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. And the funny thing is, the government gave money to the makers of Cadillac. Remember that? Cadillac got a bailout, but now when the government wants to take money, they call it the Cadillac tax. Makes no sense. It was intended to rein in the costs of what some see as overly generous health benefits, what unions saw quite a different way. Well, that potential sticking point has been unstuck. The president met with Democratic leaders until 1 a.m. last night. It looks like a compromise has been reached. Here are the details. Before the compromise, tax benefits worth $23,000 for a family would have been hit with this tax starting in the year 2018. Now for union members, the threshold is $24,000, and it doesn't start until 2018. Also, vision and dental plans that used to count towards the total now don't. With us to discuss both the politics and the policy of the argument are David Leonhardt, who writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times, and David Drucker of Roll Call. Gentlemen, hello.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, David, let's start with you. With this done, how close are we to an overall agreement, do you think?
Well, I think it's one of the key steps that had to be completed. But we still need to work on the public insurance option compromise and the overall financing of the bill, because you've now taken away some of the money to deal with paying for health care reform through this union compromise, and you're going to have to find a way to put it back in. And you still have outstanding out there the abortion issue. It may not be the most complicated of issues at the end of the day, but it's something that needs to be resolved.
And I'll ask you, David Drucker, again, because you're both David, so I will call you by your last name here from here on. So
that works.
Yes. So, Mr. Drucker, was this particular agreement, is it seen as particularly generous to the unions going in? Is this about what the people who've been following it expected the unions to get?
You know, it really was an open question all along how this would be dealt with, and I think you can look at this two ways. By striking this agreement, it forestalls or negates any worry among Democrats that one of their most generous and reliable constituencies are going to either disavow support for health care reform or sit on their hands in November. On the other hand, I think publicly this has the potential to be a political albatross, because it looks like the Democrats are cutting a deal with their friends but leaving everybody else hung out to dry. And there are, you know, maybe not a majority of families, but there are plenty of families out there who may find themselves hit by this tax because of the levels that it is set at. And the fact that they're going to be hit with the tax before union members are going to be, it could end up blowing up in their face a couple months down the line.
Now, Mr. Leonhardt, I know you like the Cadillac tax as it was written at the lower levels and phasing in earlier. Do you still like it?
Well, not as much. But I think a lot of it depends on whether we end up with what the law, what the deal set seems to suggest the law would say for 2019, in which it does apply to everyone, including union negotiated plans, or whether down the line the unions are able to negotiate a new exemption that pushes it well beyond 2018. I think it's worth – this tax is really just about the most complex part of the whole debate, and it's worth just taking a second to sort of review what the basic debate is. Right now, any income we receive from our employer is taxed, but any health insurance we receive is not taxed. And what this has done is it's led companies and unions to put more and more compensation in the untaxed part. The problem is that the evidence suggests that these really expensive plans don't provide any better health care or make people better off. They do cause them, however, to get more health care. And the idea behind this tax is to take a tiny step toward evening the tax treatment. It doesn't come close to doing so, but take a step in that direction. The unions have spent so much time negotiating, including my own union, negotiating health benefits, that they're very wary of having the value of those plans cut back. But the hope of economists who back this tax and people in the Senate and people in the White House is that this would essentially get workers to receive a raise, because we would have less of our compensation being siphoned off into health care, much of which seems to be, in the end, a subsidy for drug makers and insurance companies and hospitals and you name it. But a lot of it's going to depend on, does this exemption for union plans continue permanently, even though the law would call for it to go away in 2018?
And from reading your columns and knowing some economic theory, taxes do a couple things. They raise money that the government needs to run, but also they give signals and try to shape social behavior. So the sin taxes are, you know, supposedly to raise money and also maybe to disincentivize people from, say, smoking. This tax was supposed to disincentivize corporations from giving those extremely lucrative health care benefits, and maybe we would start bringing the cost down. As it's changed now without phasing in until, you know, years later, do you think it's still a disincentive for these kind of Cadillac plans?
Yes, I think it could be, because it phases in much sooner than 2018 for non-union plans. And what everyone's always assumed is not that workers would actually pay this tax, but that insurance companies would design new plans that came in under the threshold. And so if you imagine that they're still going to have to do that in order to come in under the threshold for non-union plans, then those plans are going to be out there. And not only that, but there's talk that as part of this deal, unions are going to be able to buy insurance plans on this new exchange that's going to be created. So you could see how the part of the tax that remains will lead insurance companies to create more affordable plans. The existence of those more affordable plans and the fact that the scare stories that we've been hearing about, you know, what it means to have a $20,000 plan for a family, which really is adequate as opposed to a $30,000 plan for a family, when the scare stories don't come true, you could absolutely see that even unions who have been fighting this are going to realize, wait a second, if we take those $20,000 plans, our workers' health is going to be the same, and they're going to be able to get more raises. And so I do still think there's a case for optimism, even though the Swiss cheese nature of this compromise, as David was suggesting, doesn't look particularly good.
And either of you guys, I guess I'll ask it to you, Mr. Leonhardt, because you're the economist. How many people who aren't in unions have such generous health benefits? Do we know the numbers or the breakdown, the percent who get this kind of benefit?
Initially, it applies to a relatively small number of workers, and certainly a relatively small number of workers who are not very high-income workers. But the issue is, over time, the tax is meant to grow. That's part of how it restrains health costs. The threshold for the tax rises at inflation plus 1%. Healthcare costs have been rising much faster than inflation plus 1%. So the way this tries to hold down taxes is by, over time, applying to more and more plans. So it is definitely true, as the unions have pointed out, that over 10 or 20 years, this would apply to more plans. Again, both opponents and supporters of it expect that most people will not actually pay this tax. What will happen instead is that insurers will change their product mix in order to come in under the threshold.
And David Drucker, Republicans, of course, only one Republican in the House and none in the Senate signed off on this bill, so they really didn't have a say. And afterwards, of course, they're criticizing it, as you would expect they would, both on logical grounds and trying to score their political points. But do Republicans, can they only blame themselves for kind of writing themselves out of the process? Would they have been smarter to have a Susan Collins or one or two senators have signed on and maybe to get in there during negotiations and tinkered with what finally came out?
It's an interesting question. I don't think so. I think that if you look at how the politics of healthcare reform has played out since the effort really hit, you know, the public's, you know, front burner last spring, there hasn't been too much support for this. And in fact, since the House passed its bill before Thanksgiving and then the Senate acted on Christmas Eve, support has dropped even further. And so I think the fact that, at least for now, when you look at this politically, the fact that there is unanimous Republican opposition has served Republicans well politically. Now, on policy grounds, you could argue that health care reform is such an important issue that you want to be in the room and you want to shape it as much as possible. I'd point out that we'll never quite know the answer to that question, but when the Senate Finance Committee was holding very bipartisan talks and negotiations, at the end of the day, neither Olympia Snowe, who has a penchant for crossing the aisle, you know, maybe because she's from Maine, but also just because she's a practical-minded independent senator, as well as Chuck Grassley, who likes being bipartisan, especially when he's working with Max Baucus, they simply could not find enough in the Senate bill to like. And when it came time for the crucial negotiations to meld the Senate, the finance bill with the Health Committee bill, Republicans weren't really invited to take part in those talks. And I think that it may be a chicken or an egg argument.
But there's just simply not much that Republicans like about the bill. And so if they were going to vote for it in any measure, it would be strictly political. We should vote for health care reform because it'll look bad if we don't. In talking to Republicans privately, even very practical-minded, you know, Republicans who occasionally show a moderate streak, they just simply didn't like it. And when you look at the politics of this and how support among the public has continued to drop, it just didn't encourage them to vote for something that they found so objectionable.
And Mike, I'd add that setting aside sort of Capitol Hill and thinking about the economic and policy aspect of this, I think Republicans not on Capitol Hill can take some comfort in the notion that they have shaped this. I mean, this looks more in many ways like Richard Nixon's version of health reform than Bill Clinton's version of health reform. Republicans who are not elected, like Mark McClellan, who was Bush's head of Medicare and was an economic advisor to Bush and is a medical doctor, have spoken positively about this bill. This is actually a fairly moderate version of health care reform. That's part of the reason we see the left so upset about the lack of public option and things like that. I think the politics have meant that it was, in the end, quite partisan, but I think the substance of it, strangely enough, is actually quite bipartisan.
And what do you think? I mean, do we need a moderate overhaul of healthcare, or do we need what, you know, the progressives are arguing? Oh, let's not debate what the definition of progressive, or do we need what someone like Move On is arguing for in terms of healthcare and single payer?
Well, I prefer a more radical remake of the healthcare system. It's not the version that Move On is necessarily arguing for. I mean, I would actually like to see the employer-based system go away. I'd like to see something more along the lines of what Ron Wyden, a Democrat of Oregon, and Bob Bennett, a Republican of Utah, proposed. It's more like the Dutch system where there's universal coverage, tight regulation, but people buy their own insurance on an exchange. But the fact is, it's easy for me to say that. The politics of that weren't there. Big business opposed it because, despite what they say, business actually like controlling the healthcare dollars of people. Unions opposed it because they also like controlling the healthcare dollars of people. So I can say that I like this idea of sort of a more radical overhaul. But the politics for it were never there. And really, the choice was between the status quo, with all of its problems with cost and spotty quality and lack of insurance, and this sort of rigged up attempt to provide more people insurance and try to hold down costs in a number of ways. And we'll see whether it works, but it strikes me that relative to the status quo, which was the real alternative, this is progress.
See, the problem with the "this is the best we were going to get" argument is that no matter how small the morsel, you could always say this is the best we were going to get. So if it's a morsel of 2 grams or 30 grams, there's no way to prove what you could have gotten. David Leonhardt, can you point to anything that you think maybe it wasn't that the Democrats did settle for, and somehow if they had either pushed, I don't know, take your pick, if they had pushed Lieberman, if they had pushed Nelson, if they had done something differently, they could have literally politically gotten something better from this bill?
I'm sure there are ways they could have done better with this bill, but I would actually think of it from the other side. So let's imagine all the possibilities for this being far less ambitious than it was, right? Let's imagine that, in fact, they decided, the Democrats, just to extend coverage for kids. Or let's say they decided not to do this big bill, but really to try to bring in Republican support, and instead of expanding coverage by 30 million people a year, they went for expanding coverage by 5 or 10 million people a year. There are people within the Democratic caucus and within the Obama administration who wish they had done that because they think that some of the political numbers that David's has been mentioning wouldn't be so bad. There is a strong political argument that, in fact, they would be better off today politically if they had done something much less ambitious. So I actually think that's sort of the better alternative to keep in mind. We don't know whether this bill will work or not, but I think as we think about the spectrum of what really was possible, this is on the relatively far end toward ambitious. That doesn't mean it's going to work, but there are a lot of reasons to think it may, and I think there are really strong reasons to think that it's more ambitious than most of the politically possible alternatives.
This is Mike Pesca filling in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and our question to you, the listeners, is we want to know if any of you fall into these categories, or if any of you maybe were right at $23,500 a year and now will not be taxed. And let's take a call on this. We're speaking with David Drucker of Roll Call and David Leonhardt of The Times, and Annette from Norwalk, Connecticut. Hello, Annette. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, my husband is self-employed. We're a family of four. He's 59. I am 49. We have two children, 6 and 4. We pay $2,400 a month for our health insurance. Are we going to get taxed on that? We are not able to get any other insurance because we cannot get underwritten.
And your husband's...
There's only one other plan available to us, and none of our doctors and none of the specialists, which we need to access, will take that insurance.
And your husband's not in a union?
No, he is self-employed. So my
right.
question is, are we going to have to pay a tax on our health insurance?
I can't answer the question about you specifically, but I think the fact that you're self-employed is the key thing here. So right now, healthcare costs for people who are self-employed, people who are unemployed, people who work at small businesses that don't provide insurance are vastly more expensive than they are for people like me who work for large companies. And that's because people who are relatively healthy, in part because people who are relatively healthy who are self-employed, often don't sign up for insurance. And so the insurers know that the people who are signing up for insurance tend to be the sicker on average. Part of what this bill does is it bars insurance companies from discriminating based on price for those sorts of pre-existing conditions and things like that. And so, again, I have no idea what's going to happen to your insurance costs. By and large, the cost of insurance for people who are self-employed under this bill will fall. And as a result, there should be plenty of insurance options that are good and that are well below the tax for people who fall into that category.
And I should mention our number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, if you think you fall into this category. And on that point, on the overall costs falling, Christina Romer, who heads the President's Economic Council, made essentially that argument on ABC's This Week. I think we have a clip of that.
The important thing, the president has said that he thinks that this excise tax on Cadillac plans is important. He's been convinced by experts across the ideological spectrum that say this is one of those things that genuinely slows the growth rate of costs. And anybody that's worried about the budget deficit knows that we've got to do that. We want to maintain that crucial focus on cost containment.
Even if it's a middle.
And she went on to say that if the plan works right, nobody's going to hit it because they're going to be bringing down costs. But my question for you, David Leonhardt, is if no one is hitting this threshold, where is the government going to get the income it needs to zero out the budget, as they say this bill will do? It will be deficit neutral.
That is a great question. So it takes us right back to this notion that right now health insurance isn't taxed and income is taxed, right? So if what it does is it leads insurance companies, instead of offering a $25,000 plan, to offer a $20,000 plan, what that means is that the cost of compensation for that worker falls by $5,000, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a clear trade-off between compensation, between health benefit, the cost of health benefits, and incomes. We see it in all kinds of negotiations, the New York doormen, GM workers, teachers. And so what will happen is then that money that had been going toward health insurance will go toward income. And income is taxed, unlike health insurance. And so that is what will raise the revenue, because it will not only be a take-home raise for workers, but it will also lead to more tax revenue for the government. And the hope, and no one knows for sure, but the evidence suggests, the hope is that moving the cost of the health plan down by a little bit will not, by a few thousand dollars, will not lead to worse health care or worse health benefits, worse health care or health quality, because there is just so much waste in our health care system.
All right, let's hear from Sean from Staten Island. You're on WNYC. Go ahead, Sean.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a union member, and I definitely would be one that would be considered on a Cadillac plan. Now, my question is, what really makes them think that the savings is going to be passed on to union employees, that this in terms of raises and other things?
Right, so this is what David Leonhardt was just talking about. Do you think that the unions, and thanks for the call, Sean, I'm going to let you go because your line's a little, I don't know, maybe you're calling from a car phone inside a Cadillac. But David, what about his question?
We don't know, but yeah. There is far more reason to think it will be passed on than it won't be. We have some specific examples. I was just looking at an example of the contract in Roxbury, New Jersey, with teachers, in which they agreed to a health plan that cost $300,000 less a year. And as part of that, they were able to afford raises equal to 4.4% a year. There's also the theory. Let's imagine two different employers. One cuts your health, cuts the cost of your health insurance, and doesn't give you a raise, and the other does. Well, which one are you going to go work for? We are in a market economy, and you can imagine, you can sort of come up with a story for, wait a second, employers are just going to drive the wages and the health benefits of everyone absolutely down as low as they can. But if that were the case, then everyone would be paying minimum wage. And clearly in our economy, everyone isn't paying minimum wage, and there's sort of competition. And the companies and employers that are going to make up this difference are going to be able to hire workers, and the ones that don't will have a much harder time of it.
David Drucker, we haven't heard about, there's one aspect of this agreement that people in high-risk professions like police officers and construction workers, they will not be affected by this tax, or maybe it's that their effectiveness will be pushed off. Now, police officers are unionized. I don't know about construction workers. Was that put in there at the behest of the unions, or was that put in there so that Democrats could have a talking point where they said, no, it's not just a sop to unions. We're helping our first responders. We're helping these people who put their lives on the line.
Well, it's unclear why they put the provision in there. I think it makes practical sense just from a common sense standpoint. If you're in a high risk profession, your rates are probably going to tend to be higher, and it's going to be hard to reduce them over time, even when you change the system. But I think politically the problem is there's no way to minimize how this looks in terms of cutting a special deal with one constituency, because for all of the very cogent arguments that David's making about the economics of this, people are not only concerned with rational economic decisions, they're concerned with fairness and how things look. And this just simply looks unfair, and that's part of the problem. And I think as we look ahead, and he sort of foreshadowed this, we don't know when this comes up and it is supposed to then apply across the board, if it's actually going to happen. It reminds me of what's known down here as the doc fix. Every year since the late 90s, Medicare providers, doctors, are supposed to have their rates adjusted downward, and every year there's a one-year fix to ensure that that doesn't happen. And there's just no way to see how this is going to play out. And conversely, for all of the good things that could happen with the bill, and there's plenty there to show that this might be, a good piece of legislation, it's hard to predict the behavior of private businesses and private corporations and exactly what they are going to do with the changes to the healthcare system and how they're going to react.
Mm-hmm. Let's take one more call. I think we have time for this. Angie from Greenbrook, New Jersey. Hello, Angie.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having this on. And my question is that my husband and I both work for companies where we both get our health insurance. We don't have any children. And his, I don't think we pay for. And mine, we pay, I think, about $150 a month. So I think we would fall in that bracket where we would probably be taxed, because I don't know how much our companies spend, but I think it would add up to probably $20,000 a year since they're separate plans. So we're thinking maybe what we should do is just get rid of the plan to pay for and go on his, or vice versa, so that it's under one plan, so it would probably bring the cost down overall. Does that sound like a good idea?
Again, I'm sure the Davids are going to say, I can't address your exact situation, but I think it speaks to maybe a larger point. There are always these unintended ways. I don't know if it would be in Angie's case, and thanks for the call, Angie, a way around it, but anything strike either of you guys as this will set off certain behaviors that maybe aren't being talked about right now?
Well, I think if
who's
I
this,
just
David?
Say quickly that what's interesting is that she doesn't know what to do, and she doesn't know what would be the best way to react to the health care reform bill personally, and that's part of the problems the Democrats are having in selling it.
Right.
I agree.
And another problem is all the good stuff that they talk about is not going to come true for a while, and all the criticisms can be leveled today, yesterday, and tomorrow.
Yes, correct. Although a lot of the insurance regulations will take effect sooner. The stuff that helps people who don't have insurance get insurance don't take effect for a number of years.
All right. I want to thank both you guys, David Drucker from Roll Call Magazine, David Leonhard, who writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. Thanks very much.
Thank you,
Mike.